If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Combination of supremacist to victim is Hindutva, and under Hindutva, any sign of, you know, Islam, Muslims, is an anathema. So holding on to Kashmir became a symbolic thing, and this is a sense shared even by many Indian liberals who believe that if India were to give freedom to Kashmir, India would fall apart. Nobody has explained to Kashmiris why that is the case. Why would giving the right to self-determination to a people would cause India to fall apart? It only shows that India is being held together by force, perhaps.
That's Mohammed Junaid, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. India's democracy is being systematically disassembled, says renowned writer and activist Arundhati Roy. She adds, any kind of dissent is just smashed with an iron fist. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party openly espouse Hindutva, a racist ideology rooted in a mythical past and fueled by magical thinking. It's a supremacist doctrine that privileges and elevates one group, Hindus, over all others. Its animus toward Muslims is particularly acute, but Christians and other minorities also incur its wrath. Hindutva nationalists want to dominate Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority state. The Himalayan region has endured decades of occupation by hundreds of thousands of Indian troops. There is resistance. Tens of thousands of Kashmiris are dead and missing. Human rights violations are routine. Yet, the Kashmiri quest for Azadi, freedom, continues. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, David.
India is the world's not only largest so-called democracy, but now also its most populous one. Interrogate the nature of Indian democracy, particularly when it comes to Kashmir.
Well, India is definitely the largest democracy within quotes because it has a very large number of people living in it, many of whom do participate in elections every 5 years. But Indian democracy has become a majoritarian one. The ruling BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which has been ruling now since 2014, has turned a large chunk of the population into one massive vote bank under the name of Hindu nationalism. These people simply vote on symbolic issues, cultural issues that they believe relate to the interests of Hindus, which means that a large section of the population, minorities, they're like close to 20% Muslims. There are a large number of Dalits who are the historically marginalized undercastes, have been effectively disenfranchised. BJP has made sure that these people's votes do not matter at any level, either at the constituency level or at the parliamentary level. Right now, while the percentage of Muslims, for instance, is between 18 to 20%, there is less than 3% representation they have in the parliament. And the ruling BJP has literally zero. I mean, there would be a couple of them, you could count them on the fingers, members of the parliament. That, and they don't field candidates in state elections who are Muslims or from any minorities. So India is a democracy in terms of having these regular elections every 5 years, but the meaning of democracy has effectively completely changed. It's no longer what it used to be.
And Kashmir is a Muslim majority area.
So Kashmir has always been a kind of state of exception within the Indian political system. Historically, the way it was annexed into the Indian Union and the way Indian political system worked or created institutions in Kashmir has always made sure that Kashmir effectively has no voice. It is an occupied territory, it's colonized, and we will soon talk about the events of August 5, 2019. But even before then, elections in Kashmir, which used to happen sometimes they would just be suspended, have often been marred by riggings, by, you know, suppressing the opposition, by, you know, disenfranchising large sections of the people, and sometimes coercing people to vote for the candidates that Indian government wanted to win the state assembly elections.
August 5th, 2019, the proverbial tectonic plate shift. What happens on that day? And it's interesting that in a prior conversation, you told me that the day before you had left Kashmir on August 4th to return to the United States.
Yes, August 5th, 2019 was the day that the military occupation in more formal terms became settler colonialism. A series of changes were introduced in Indian Parliament by the ruling Modi, you know, led BJP government, and Kashmir had absolutely no say in those changes. Not only that, Kashmir was put into sort of a 7-month-long communication blockade, military siege. The entire population for 4 months couldn't go out of their homes. And I was there just before these changes took place. I left Kashmir, in fact, on morning of August 4, a day before, because there were ominous signs everywhere. Around 180,000 paramilitary soldiers were brought into Kashmir, and this is in addition to the already existing 750,000 Indian soldiers who are spread out across Kashmir. You'd go out and you'd see them, you know, in long convoys coming, hurtling down from India, and you knew that something big was taking place. And the rumors were that there might be a war along the effective border between India and Pakistan in Kashmir. It's called the line of control. And there were other rumors that there might be a mass crackdown on Kashmiri militants. You know, these are like people who are fighting the Indian state and have taken up arms, or that there would be, you know, all the Tehrik leaders. Tehrik is the name of this historic struggle for self-determination in Kashmir, and that their leaders would be all arrested and put behind bars. The prehistory goes back to of August 5 goes back to actually when Modi came to power in 2014, and a Kashmiri party called People's Democratic Party won the elections in Kashmir, but they chose to also they didn't have a majority. But instead of aligning with any other party in Kashmir, they decided to align with BJP. And so the BJP and PDP formed a coalition government, which lasted for another 4 years. But in October 2018, BJP withdrew support from the government. And so Kashmir had no elected government within quotes. And the governor rule was imposed, which was followed by a presidential rule. Then, if you recall, in February 2019, there was a bomb blast on a highway in Kashmir, and I think 40 Indian paramilitary soldiers were killed in that attack, which led to India, you know, sending fighter bombers into Pakistani-held side of Kashmir, and then Pakistan responded, and Indian jet was downed, which led to almost like a couple of weeks of, you know, serious tensions between India and Pakistan. Those issues got resolved a little bit, but in Kashmir there was a big crackdown on Tehrik activists, Tehrik leaders. Many parties were banned, JKLF, Jamaat Islami, and many other Hurriyat parties. Hurriyat is like the conglomeration of many Kashmiri parties who have been historically fighting for the right to self-determination. And then it led to this event in August 5, 2019. So on the morning of August 4th, I decided to leave. I knew that if I stayed. I could get stuck for months. I mean, I've had previous experience in 2016 when India, after killing a popular Kashmiri rebel leader, imposed close to 3 months of blockade, and I had a very difficult time leaving Kashmir. And so then the next day, when I reached Delhi and I was flying out to New York, I came to realize that India had just introduced these two legislations in the parliament. One of them was about withdrawing a historical article called Article 370, which had been negotiated between Kashmiri leaders, pro-India leaders, and Indian government in 1953 and before, and had established some sort of a semi-autonomous status for the state of Kashmir. And then the other part of this was the withdrawal of Article 35A, which was also part of the Indian Constitution, which allowed the government of Kashmir, the elected government of Kashmir, to determine residency requirements in Kashmir and who could hold land, for instance, who could buy purchase land. The third part of this whole process on August 5th was they introduced a bill called the Jammu and Kashmir Reorganization Bill, which effectively turned the historical state of Jammu and Kashmir, which had included Ladakh region, into two union territories. You know, there has never been a case like that after 1947 where an entity, a federal entity like a state, could be turned down into a union territory. The Indian government arbitrarily, without any reference to the people of Kashmir, Ladakh, or Jammu, decided to just reduce the status of the state into two union territories. It, for instance, meant that Kashmir would not have its legislative assembly, or even if it had ever an election again, I mean, since then we have not had any election in Kashmir, that assembly would not have any powers. Institutions like Kashmir police came under the effective control of the Union Home Minister.
Well, it fundamentally changed the governance structure.
Yes, Article 370 was negotiated, I mean, and it's important to remember that, between those leaders in Kashmir who were already pro-India, who had sort of in 1947 supported the instrument of accession. And this was a treaty signed by the Hindu Maharaja of Kashmir with the Indian government, which had given India powers over three areas, defense, communication, and foreign affairs. So Article 370 sort of formalized this relationship a bit more. In 1954, India had, which was then under Nehru, had already passed what is called a presidential order, which took away parts of that, effective parts of that article. For instance, it happened in the aftermath of Nehru arresting his friend Sheikh Abdullah, the Kashmiri leader. Over the next seven decades, India effectively took over more and more powers out of Kashmir. You know, it's just imposed, for instance, the rule of its Supreme Court, of its election commission, of many other institutions, right? So Article 370 would have prevented, if it had been carried out in its full spirit, it would have prevented Indian government from interfering in Kashmir outside of the three parameters: defense, communication, and external affairs. So by 2019, the Article 370 was effectively an empty article. Substantively, there was really nothing in it, you know. India already sort of ruled Kashmir from the center in many ways, because Kashmir was under a sort of a military administration. The governor had a lot of power, and the governor in Kashmir is actually imposed by the Indian government. So the August 5th changes were a way for Modi to have this spectacle that, see, I could take away this article, because he is part of an organization called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is a mothership of a lot of Hindu majoritarian parties. And their agenda from the very beginning, which means right after 1947, was that they could not brook Kashmir having any autonomy. or any sign of autonomy. Like, you know, even after 1953, Kashmir continued to have its own flag. It had its own constitution. Its highest elected post was called the Prime Minister, just like in India. Even though after 1965, many of these things had been taken away by the Congress government, but the RSS, you know, in its manifestos, in its programs, would often say that we want to take even those symbolic elements away from Kashmir. What was most consequential in the changes that were made were two. One was the removal of Article 35A, because now the Indian government could allow Indians, like from mainland India, to come in and settle permanently in Kashmir. It would also remove residency requirements and giving permanent residency certificates or papers to people from India to come into Kashmir, which is what it has done ever since. And this other key component of this was giving mineral rights to Indian companies to come in and extract minerals from Kashmir. You know, one of the most consequential thing that happened right in the aftermath of Article 370's removal was giving these licenses to riverbeds, to Indian sand companies, which is a huge mafia in India. And they immediately began to bring these large excavators, caterpillar excavators to Kashmir and started digging the riverbeds, destroying really ecologically fragile land in Kashmir. So the second part that I wanted to talk about was the legality of the removal of the Article 370. It was very well understood by both many, by Kashmiris as well as India's constitutional experts that Article 370 was literally unremovable. It was a permanent thing, although Indian government had put it in a section called temporary measures in the constitution. But it was effectively permanent because the Article 370 could only be removed through a concurrence of what was called the Jammu and Kashmir Constituent Assembly. It's written in the 370's Clause 3 that without the concurrence of Jammu and Kashmir Constituent Assembly, the Indian government cannot remove it. But that Constituent Assembly did not exist in 2019. It had ceased to exist in 1957 after they passed the Jammu and Kashmir Constitution. And so many Kashmiris, especially the pro-India leadership of National Conference and PDP, believed that 370 was unremovable. Now, what the Indian government did was they claimed that we could read Legislative Assembly as Constituent Assembly. And so we don't need the Constituent Assembly. We could have the concurrence of the Legislative Assembly. And then they said, since there is no Legislative Assembly, well, we could read Governor of Kashmir, his concurrence as representing the Legislative Assembly. That's highly undemocratic because the governor does not represent anybody. He just is an Indian representative in Kashmir. You know, so even former judges of the Supreme Court, India's Supreme Court, many of its legal luminaries, all believed that the way Indian government carried out this process was not constitutional. It went against the spirit of the constitution. And also the second part, the turning the state into two union territories was unheard of, because in the Indian constitution, you cannot reduce the area of a state from the center, without the concurrence and recommendation of the state assembly. And you cannot turn a state into a union territory. So what India did was then to show that it was an act of sovereignty for it. Right? It could give itself exception from its own constitution. Although, recently the India Supreme Court, which has had a kind of a terrible record recently, in terms of claiming multiple times that what the government is doing is not right, but in the end still going ahead and supporting the government. So they now have given the judgment that the process through which this was carried out was not right, but they agreed with the government's actions. which clearly tells Kashmiris that they absolutely have no democratic future in Kashmir. They are at the mercy of the majoritarian state.
Why does Kashmir occupy such a large space in the imagination of Hindu nationalists?
It is the only Muslim majority state in India. It becomes easy for the Hindu nationalists to whip up emotions among its constituents around Kashmir. My understanding of Hindu nationalism is that it is simultaneously a supremacist ideology and a victimized ideology. You know, they claim that they have historically been victimized by Muslims and, you know, outside, which they claim are outsiders. And they also say that they are better than everybody else, you know, that should be the ideology of the Indian state. This combination of supremacist to victim is Hindutva. And under Hindutva, any sign of, you know, Islam, Muslims, is an anathema. So Kashmir, although, you know, it has not had much role to play in the Indian subcontinent, because our historical connections were mostly with Central Asia, Iran, Tibet, and not so much with South Asia, you know, the Indian mainland or Pakistani mainland, so to speak. We kind of became trapped within this Hindu nationalist imagination. For them, somehow holding on to Kashmir became a symbolic thing. And this is a sense shared even by many Indian liberals who believe that if India were to give freedom to Kashmir, India would fall apart. Nobody has explained to Kashmiris why that is the case. Why would giving the right to self-determination to a people would cause India to fall apart? It only shows that India is being held together by force, perhaps.
India's first prime minister was Nehru, who himself was a Kashmiri Pandit, a Kashmiri Hindu. He made multiple promises, representations in 47, 48, 49 period after partition, that the legitimate rights of representation will accrue to the Kashmiri people. In other words, they could vote on whether they wanted to be part of India, part of Pakistan, or independent.
Nehru indeed traced his lineage back to Kashmiri Pandit family. Pandits are Kashmiri Hindus. Although they had left in the middle of the 19th century, their family, and Nehru was not born in Kashmir. He had no association with Kashmir up until 1944, when it became clear that the British might leave soon. And so he wanted to secure more and more territory for India. So by 1946-47, as his visits to Kashmir became more frequent, he became much more interested in acquiring Kashmir. Kashmir at that time was, and continues to be, a Muslim-majority region, but it was under a Hindu monarchy, which was highly unpopular because, you know, it was repressive, it was, as historian Mridu Roy wrote, it was a Hindu state ruling over a Muslim subject population. So while he may have had sympathies with the Hindu state, he also wanted some kind of Kashmiri Muslim participation in the annexation of Kashmir, because this was a time that United Nations had come up. The world had just gone through this traumatic war, the Second World War. And there was like a lot of hope that we could perhaps build a better future, a world where dominant powers no longer have, you know, these expansionist ideologies. So within that spirit, you know, this is in 1947, the war between India and Pakistan broke out. This is happening in the context of the partition of the subcontinent. And Kashmir at that time was an autonomous independent entity, although it was under the overall British suzerainty, but it was not directly controlled by them. And the Hindu Maharaja himself was not clear whether he wanted to join India or Pakistan. It's likely, and there's much historical evidence to that, that he wanted to remain independent. But at that time, again, the RSS activists arrived in Kashmir. Nehru forced the Maharaja to dismiss his Prime Minister, R.C. Kak, who wanted an independent Kashmir, and to basically employ a congressman named Mahajan, who was a judge, a retired judge from Calcutta, but also an acolyte of Nehru, to be the prime minister. Together, Maharaja's family, RSS, this Mahajan, they began to disarm Muslims from the Jammu region, which is the southern part, and arm the Hindus, and created this conditions for a massacre in which we know that more than 200,000 Muslims were massacred or disappeared completely. You know, Jammu used to be, for instance, a Muslim majority city, and by the end of the massacres in November and December, hardly any Muslims were left in the city. And during this context too, the people from Northwest Frontier Province, hearing stories of these traumas, began to arrive in Kashmir to help Kashmiri Muslims. Eventually, what it led to was a war between India and Pakistan, which ended in a stalemate because neither could win all of the territory, and Kashmiris were left helpless in this process. And that became the foundation for a format which we have sort of inherited since then. Kashmir became one of the first cases in the United Nations. The first few resolutions, for instance, that the UN passed, UN Security Council passed, were all about plebiscite in Kashmir. For instance, the Resolution 47 of United Nations Security Council, which was passed in 1948, called for a ceasefire in Kashmir, called for demilitarization in Kashmir, and plebiscite, where people of Kashmir would be asked whether they want to join India or Pakistan. And Nehru promised that this was going to happen. But by 1951, 52, he had given up on all of this. I mean, it's very clear that he never was sincere about it.
Arundhati Roy, in her book, The Architecture of Modern Empire, says, in Kashmir, you have a situation of what she calls terror, that any kind of dissent, I'm quoting here, that any kind of dissent, any disagreement, any sharing of the horrors that people are enduring is just smashed with an iron fist. People are in jail, journalists are threatened. Then she adds, I don't know how long you can have 6 million people living in a situation like that. So what's going on day to day in Kashmir? You have the prime minister in March visiting for the first time since the abrogation of Article 370, saying that Kashmir now is, quote, breathing freely, and it is a new Jammu and Kashmir that we have been waiting decades for, Prime Minister Modi said.
He clearly is concocting a reality that most Kashmiris do not live in. I think that any sane person outside Kashmir, not to mention inside Kashmir, would know that Kashmir is a highly militarized region. There's a huge army sitting on top of the population, breathing down their necks. The Indian state has put a foot on the neck of all Kashmiris. It's a state of enforced silence. Journalists, Kashmiri intellectuals, writers, artists, they're living in terror of the state. Indian government has a number of institutions, security institutions like the National Intelligence Agency, the State Intelligence Agency, the Enforcement Directorate, not to mention regular armed forces and counterinsurgency formations, and Jammu and Kashmir police, who are continuously looking at any sign of dissidence. This is not merely now speech or writing, but also possessing things like a photograph that might suggest that, it's this Kashmiri could be suspect. Yeah. So everything is under surveillance. There is digital, manual surveillance. Cameras everywhere. There is quadcopters and drones flying all around the place. This is all Modi has created, and the previous regimes too. So I don't know who he is talking about when he says people are breathing free.
The destruction of the Babri Masjid in 1992 was a major event in this chronology of what's been happening to not just Kashmiri Muslims, but Muslims in India. It triggered a major massacre at the time.
Yeah, it was a turning point in Indian politics too. And it goes back to 1986 when the Indian government opened the doors of the mosque and did what is called the Shilanyas, laying the bricks foundation for the temple. This site had been under in contest since during the British era too, but it was a very regional, marginal conflict. You know, it wasn't like a national level